Chapter 1. An Eventful Visit to the Florists. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. Lucy had enough work to do. Rumpelmayer's workmen were coming to take the doors off. And what a fresh morning it was, thought Clarissa Dalloway. Just like being at the seaside. On days like this at Boughton, as a girl of 18, she had burst open the French windows and plunged into the fresh, calm open air. Yet she also remembered standing at the open window, serious, thinking that something terrible was about to happen. She would stand and look at the flowers and the trees and the birds until Peter Walsh said, perhaps at breakfast, "Talking to the vegetables, were you?" Peter Walsh. He would be coming back from India soon. Clarissa remembered his eyes, his pocket knife, his smile, and his grumpiness. Clarissa waited on the curb for a van to pass. Meanwhile, Scrope Purvis saw her and thought, as much as he knew his next-door neighbour in Westminster, a charming woman, full of energy, even though she is over 50. And has gone very white since her illness. Clarissa recalled that she had lived in Westminster for over 20 years now. As she crossed Victoria Street, Big Ben struck. First of all the musical warning, then the hour. Boom. She wondered why most people in this city loved life so much, amidst the traffic. And this was what she loved. Life. London. This moment in mid-June. The war was over, thank heaven. The King and Queen were at Buckingham Palace, and everywhere there was activity in this grey-blue early morning air. And Clarissa, too, loved it because she was going to give her party that night. How strange, then, walking into St. James's Park, was the silence, the ducks swimming slowly. And who was that walking along? Her old dear, admirable friend Hugh Whitbread.
"Good morning to you, Clarissa," said Hugh, rather extravagantly. "Where are you off to?"
"I love walking in London," said Mrs. Dalloway. "Really, it's better than walking in the country." Other people came to London to see exhibitions. The Whitbreads came to London to see doctors. Clarissa had visited Evelyn Whitbread many times in a nursing home. Was Evelyn ill again?
"Nothing serious," said Hugh, and he quickly moved away, assuring her that he and Evelyn would be at her party.
Clarissa felt aware of her hat. Not the right hat for the early morning. Was that it? Hugh always made her feel a little underdressed. But he was a good person, though he nearly drove Richard mad, and Peter Walsh had never forgiven her for liking Hugh. How she and Peter had argued! He had said she would marry a prime minister and stand at the top of a staircase, the perfect hostess, he called her. She had cried about that in her bedroom. She had the makings of the perfect hostess, he said. She had been right not to marry Peter Walsh, for in marriage there must be a little independence between people living together day in, day out in the same house, which Richard gave her and she him. Where was he this morning, for instance? But with Peter, everything had to be shared. And when, in the little garden at Boughton by the fountain, she had to break with him, or they would have been destroyed, she was convinced, though there was sadness in her heart for years, and then the shocking moment when someone told her at a concert that he had married a woman he met on the boat going to India. He was quite happy, he assured her, although he had never done a thing that they had talked of. His whole life had been a failure. It made Clarissa angry still. She had reached the park gates. She stood for a moment, looking at the omnibuses in Piccadilly. She felt very young, at the same time unspeakably old.
had a perpetual sense of being out, out, far out to sea and alone. She always had the feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. She knew nothing, no language, no history. She hardly ever read a book now, but to her, all this was absolutely absorbing. Her only gift was knowing people almost by instinct. Did it matter then, she asked herself, that she must inevitably cease to exist completely? All this must go on without her, that somehow, in the streets of London, she survived, Peter survived, lived in each other, she being part of the trees at home, of the house there, part of people she had never met. But what was she dreaming as she looked into Hatchard's shop window? She read in the book spread open, "Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages." There were a lot of books, but none that seemed exactly right to take to Evelyn Whitbread in her nursing home. Nothing that would amuse her. Clarissa turned and walked back towards Bond Street, annoyed, because it was silly to have other reasons for doing things. She would have preferred to be like Richard, who did things for themselves. But half the time, she did things to make people think this or that. Bond Street early in the morning fascinated her. Its shops. She paused for a moment at the window of a glove shop. She had a passion for gloves, but her own daughter Elizabeth didn't care at all for them. Elizabeth really cared for her dog Grizzle most of all. Still, that was better than Miss Kilman. Richard said it might be only a phase which all girls go through. It might be falling in love. But why with Miss Kilman? She had been badly treated, of course. Anyhow, they were inseparable. Every year Miss Kilman wore that green Macintosh coat. She perspired. She always made you feel her superiority, your inferiority. How poor she was, how rich you were. No doubt, in another life, she would have loved Miss Kilman, but not in this world. Nonsense, nonsense, she cried to herself as she entered Mulberry's, the florist's, to be greeted at once by button-faced Miss Pym, whose hands were always bright red, as if they had been stood in cold water with the flowers. She looked older this year. There were delphiniums, sweet peas, bunches of lilac, and carnations, masses of carnations. There were roses, there were irises. Clarissa breathed in the earthy, garden sweet smell as she stood talking to Miss Pym. While she began to go with her from jar to jar, choosing, she said, "Nonsense, nonsense," to herself, more and more gently, when, oh, a pistol shot in the street outside. "Dear, those motor cars," said Miss Pym, going to the window to look, and coming back and smiling apologetically, as if those tyres of motor cars were all her fault. The violent explosion which made Mrs. Dalloway jump and Miss Pym go to the window and apologise came from a motor car which had pulled up precisely opposite Mulberry's shop window. Passers-by stopped and stared and had just enough time to see a very important face against the dove-grey upholstery before a male hand drew the blind and there was nothing more to be seen. Yet rumours were at once in circulation. Was it the Prince of Wales? The Queen's? The Prime Minister's? Whose face was it? Nobody knew. Septimus Warren Smith, aged about 30, pale-faced, with hazel eyes, beak-nosed, wearing brown shoes and a shabby overcoat, found himself unable to pass. Everything had come to a standstill. The motor car had stopped outside Mulberry's shop window. Mrs. Dalloway, with her arms full of sweet peas, looked out. Everyone looked at the motor car. Septimus looked. I am blocking the way, he thought. Let us go on, Septimus, said his wife, a little Italian woman with large eyes and a pointed face. Lucrezia herself could not help looking at the motor car. Was it the Queen in there? The Queen going shopping? Come on, said Lucrezia. But her husband, for they had been married 4 or 5 years now, jumped and said, All right, angrily, as if she had interrupted him. People must notice, she thought, looking at the crowd staring at the motor car. Septimus had said, I will kill myself. Suppose they had heard him. Help! Help! She wanted to cry out. Now we will cross the road, said Lucrezia. So simple, so impulsive, only 24, without friends in England, she who had left Italy for his sake. The motor car, with its blinds drawn, proceeded towards Piccadilly. The face itself had been seen only once by 3 people for a few seconds, but greatness was definitely seated inside. Greatness was passing, hidden, down Bond Street. It is probably the Queen, thought Mrs. Dalloway, coming out of Mulberry's with her flowers. The traffic was terrible for the time of day, the Queen herself unable to pass. The chauffeur said or showed something to the policeman, who saluted, and the car passed through, slowly and very silently. Clarissa guessed she had seen something white, magical, circular in the footman's hand, a disc inscribed with a name, the Queen's, the Prince of Wales's, the Prime Minister's. Gliding across Piccadilly, the car turned down St. James's Street. A small crowd, meanwhile, had gathered at the gates of Buckingham Palace. The Prince lived at St. James's, but he might come along in the morning to visit his mother. So Sarah Bletchley said, with her baby in her arms, while Emily Coates looked at the palace windows and thought of all the housemaids, all the bedrooms. The crowd increased. Little Mr. Bowley actually had tears in his eyes. He raised his hat as the car turned into the Mall and held it high as the car approached. Suddenly, Mrs. Coates looked up into the sky. An aeroplane was coming over the trees, letting out white smoke from behind, making letters in the sky. Everyone looked up. What letters? A, C, was it? An E, then an L? For a moment they lay still, then they melted in the sky, and the aeroplane shot further away, and again in a fresh space of sky, and began writing a K, an E, a Y perhaps. Glaxo, said Mrs. Coates, looking straight up, and her baby lying in her arms gazed straight up. Creamo, murmured Mrs. Bletchley. With his hat held out perfectly still in his hand, Mr. Bowley gazed straight up. As they looked, the whole world became perfectly silent, and a flight of gulls crossed the sky. And in this extraordinary silence and peace, bells struck 11 times, the sound fading up there among the gulls. The aeroplane turned and swooped exactly where it liked. That's an E, said Mrs. Bletchley. It's toffee, murmured Mr. Bowley, and the car went in at the palace gates, and nobody looked at it. The plane shut off the smoke and rushed away. It had gone. There was no sound. The clouds to which the letters E, G, or L had attached themselves moved freely. Then suddenly, as a train comes out of a tunnel, the aeroplane rushed out of the clouds again, soared up, and wrote one letter after another. But what word was it writing? Lucrezia Warren Smith, sitting by her husband's side on a seat in Regent's Park, looked up.
"Look, look, Septimus!" she cried,
for Dr. Holmes had told her to make her husband take an interest in things outside himself. "So," thought Septimus, looking up, "they are signalling to me." Tears filled his eyes as he looked at the smoke words melting in the sky and leaving him with shapes of unimaginable beauty. Tears ran down his cheeks. It was toffee. They were advertising toffee, a nursemaid told Retzia. Together, they began to spell T-O-F-K-R, said the nursemaid, and Septimus heard her say K-R close to his ear, deeply, softly, but with a roughness in her voice. He shut his eyes. He would see no more.
Septimus, said Retzia.
He started violently.
I am going to walk to the fountain and back, she said,
for she could stand it no longer. Dr. Holmes might say there was nothing wrong with Septimus. She could not sit beside him when he stared like that and did not see her and made everything terrible. Septimus has been working too hard. That was all she could say to her own mother. Looking back, she saw him sitting in his shabby overcoat alone on the seat, staring. Septimus had fought in the war. He was brave, but he was not Septimus now. She put on her new hat, and he never noticed, and he was happy without her. Nothing could make her happy without him. He was selfish, like all men. It was she who suffered, but she had nobody to tell. Italy, with its white houses, and the room where her sisters sat making hats, and the streets crowded every evening with people, walking, laughing out loud, was far away. There was nobody. Her words faded. I am alone. I am alone. She cried by the fountain in Regent's Park. For he was gone, she thought. But no, there he was, still sitting alone on the seat, talking aloud. What are you saying? Said Retzia, suddenly sitting down by him. Interrupted again. She was always interrupting. Away from people. They must get away from people, he said, jumping up. Right away, over there, where there were chairs under a tree. There, they sat down. The way to Regent's Park Tube Station. Could they tell her the way? Maisie Johnson wanted to know. She had only arrived from Edinburgh 2 days ago. Not this way, over there, Retzia exclaimed, waving her away, in case she should see Septimus. Both seemed queer, Maisie Johnson thought. The aeroplane. Away and away it shot over Greenwich, over the little island of grey churches, St. Paul's, and the rest until, on either side of London, fields spread out. It was strange. It was still. There was no sound to be heard above the traffic. The aeroplane curved freely up and up, straight up, and white smoke poured out from behind, looping, writing a T, an O, an F.